When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to what's becoming an annual tradition here on the Legends of the Old West podcast. My interview with New York Times bestselling author Craig Johnson about his latest Walt Longmire mystery novel. The newest installment in the series is called Land of Wolves, and Craig and I reunited at the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona to talk about it. As you'll hear, this interview took place 2 days after the release of the book, so we stayed clear of any major spoilers. You are going to hear about a couple small details, but I promise they don't give anything away about the plot or the twists or anything like that. And we also talked a little bit about writing, because I know we've got some authors or some aspiring authors in the audience, so I think you'll hear some good stuff from Craig on that topic. And finally, just a quick update on another update that's coming out soon. I've planned a major update about the show for a long time, but every time I get ready to release it, something new happens and it delays the update. So I'll be back in a couple weeks to fully explain what's been going on and why we've been gone for so long and what's coming up in the future. Some great things have happened over the last few months, but I just want to wait until they're totally finalized before I talk about them. Thanks for your patience during this unexpectedly long break and this longer than normal opening. So now let's get to Craig Johnson and our discussion of Land of Wolves. Craig, thanks for coming back. I appreciate it. This is round three on the Legends of the Old West
podcast.
Does
that mean I'm a veteran?
I thought about it this morning. You have the exalted status of being the only recurring guest on this show.
Oh, my goodness.
You have the distinction of being the only one who's been back more than once.
Oh, wow. I am a combat-hardened veteran.
Tell you what, thank you very much for enduring it. Three tours.
My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure.
So what I thought we might do this time around, luckily this time, if any listeners who would have heard last year's episode, I had not quite finished the audiobook version before we sat down to do this. This year, okay. I can say that I have finished the book.
Okay.
The whole thing is in the bag.
Don't give anything away.
I'm not going to give anything away. That's okay. What I was going to say. We've got several things to talk about with the book, where they're all going to be talked about obliquely and in vague terms.
No, I'm just laughing because I'm always telling other people, don't give anything away, and then inevitably I'm the one that gives something away. Like it, so
we're going to try and stay clear of them. I do want to touch on some things, but we'll obviously stay vague. I don't want to spoil anything. We're doing this interview 2 days after the book has come out.
Yeah.
When people hear this episode, if they listen to it fairly soon after its release, it'll still be within a week.
Yeah.
So we definitely don't want to give anything away for anyone who picks up the book down the road. So I wanted to do a couple things. I want to talk about the book in a couple ways, but I also want to talk to you about writing in general.
Uh-huh.
So that we don't get too deep into the book and reveal any spoilers. I know that we have some aspiring authors in the audience.
Uh-huh.
I have met them and talked to them. I know that there are some new authors. They've written one or two books. And so
uh-huh.
I just want to hear some stories from you and hear some of your tales that might help them as they're moving through the process.
I'll do my best. I'll try.
So we're going to split time a little bit. We'll kind of bounce back and forth.
But okay.
I wanted to start here because I thought this was a fantastic moment in the book, which harkened back to our very first interview in Billings, Wyoming at the Western Writers Convention.
Uh-huh.
I asked you for a story that you love from the Old West.
Right.
And you told me the story of Buffalo Bill Cody's body.
Yep.
And that story made its way into the book. And I'm not going to give too many details away about it, but I thought that was interesting. So how did that story make it in? And that was, I had a huge smile on my face listening to it and remembering our first interview.
You know, I got to admit that what happened was I acquired a cabin up in the Bighorn Mountains, an old cabin. way up there, about 8,000 feet, like it. And I, you know, started doing the research on it because it was kind of an odd cabin. The way it was structured and everything just didn't seem like the usual mountain cabin. And I thought there must be some kind of a history to this thing or something. And come to find out that it actually was, you know, the headquarters for the National Order of Cowboy Rangers. And so that's, you know, where I started digging up the ideas and getting the idea that, like, you know, well, there's got to be a story to go along with this. And there were a lot of stories to go along with this. But the big epic one was the one where, you know, they actually dispatched a couple of riders from Lodge 34 or Ranch 34, like that, which was where that particular, I guess, social group happened to be, like a fraternal group happened to be. And they're the ones that went after the body of Buffalo Bill, you know, down in Denver, like to try and bring it back. And I kind of, you know, thought, okay, well, if I'm going to float this cabin into Walt's world, you know, and it's going to be, you know, part of his lexicon, then, you know, maybe I probably need to, you know, advance that idea and get that idea out there already, like that, so that when I do write that particular book, you know, it'll have a little bit of a backstory to it already.
All right. So that's all those, so those threads that are in the book as well, like the cabin and all that history that you detail in the book about
Absolutely.
That group of Rangers, that's all true. And
it
that
is,
all comes
it
directly
is.
From what, your
what,
life
maybe
experience.
What we'll have to do is you'll have to come up like it and we'll do the next episode, you know, off the porch, you know,
oh,
the cabin
that'd
there
be
in the
fantastic.
Big
can it just be rented out for a long period
sure,
of time?
Sure, sure. Well, it's not, I'm working on it right now. I need a little bit of work. I guess,
it, might it might resemble Walt's cabin.
Oh, yeah, maybe worse. Maybe far worse.
Well, at least we can sit on the front porch. As long as it has a working front porch, that's really the best part of the whole
nice
operation.
Spot.
Perfect. Well, thinking about small other details that you worked in there, I did love a small one that I want to reveal here. This is not really a spoiler, but I love the inclusion of these Tom Mix toy badges. And this is going to get into a writing question as well. I love that. So how did you discover these? Are these real? Were they, you tend to put a lot of these little real details in there.
Yeah.
Where'd you find that one?
Well, they're the real deal. Again, and I've actually got one sitting on my, you know, on my writing
desk. I assumed you probably did.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so I just started thinking about it and I thought, okay, I needed something like that. I don't want to give too much away like that, but there was a character there that didn't speak. And he needed an ability to kind of draw attention to himself at one point, you know,
sure.
in the story, like maybe twice in the story, like that, or three times in the story. And so I started thinking about it and I thought, okay, that might work. Like, and then I started thinking, you know, well, how in the heck do you get some toy from the late 1940s into the hands of a kid nowadays? Like,
right.
And so I started working on that idea and I thought, okay, well, you know, if Ruby, you know, can't get a drawer opener, it won't close all the way. And they discovered that these were actually leftovers from when Lucian Connolly was the sheriff there in Absaroka County and used to give them away to kids. Like it seemed like a way to kind of, you know, go back and touch base with a previous period, like at include, you know, Lucian in that storyline. But then also do everything that I needed it to do, like that, to actually, you know, draw attention to, you know, this child, like without him being able to speak. You know, you always run into certain problems whenever you have a character who has limitations, you know, in speech patterns, like that, because if they have to convey something in the plot, like that, then, you know, it starts getting a little bit tough, like that. And so it was, you know, it was a way to try and solve that problem.
Do you enjoy writing challenges like that for yourself? Like when you come up with an idea, do you quickly then realize, oh, okay, if I really want to use this, now I have to figure out the challenge of how this is going to work and where's the backstory come from? Do you find that as a fun part of the process, kind of almost painting yourself into a corner to a degree and then figuring out how to get out of it?
Oh yeah, like, and I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, when you're writing that first draft, you know, that's when you discover all those problems, like,
oh,
and, you know,
yeah.
And then, you know, I mean, then you got plenty of time like that to go through like that and try and figure, you know, the answers out, you know, and hopefully you will, like, you know, you don't want to ever make a situation that you're like, well, that, you know, well, what you have to do then is you have to abandon the idea, like,
yeah.
And it's always very painful to have to do that. So, you know, I was fortunate, look at that, I thought, okay, wait a minute, look at, and of course I had one laying on my desk,
sure.
which kind of made it a little bit easier, like that, but yeah, and then trying to make that connection, you know, between the epic romantic American West, you know, and then the contemporary West, that's always
sure.
a challenge too.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that in a second, but I want to focus for a quick second on some of those details, like the Tom Mix badge, I think is interesting. So I guessed you probably had one of those, or at least you'd seen one of those. You seem to put a lot of those things in.
Oh, yeah.
Like the cabin that we just talked about. I
oh,
didn't
yeah.
know that that was probably real life, but you go into such thorough detail about some of these
well,
things, and it
you.
Feels like they
thank
have to
you.
Be drawn somewhat from personal experience. So for a writing question, how important do you think those kinds of details are, both maybe in a plot function and then the character details? And the one that really springs to mind is Vic's eye color, or the tarnished gold that you
right.
always use to describe her
right.
eyes. For aspiring authors, how reliable, how how big do you think those details are to put in your books?
That's your lifeblood is what it is. If you don't, you know, I mean, you can be generic like that, you know, whenever you're writing, but that really isn't going to lead anywhere like that. I mean, you have to be as specific as you can possibly be. One of the biggest mistakes that I see a lot of young writers make is they're always shooting for a kind of a universal kind of quality to try and like reach as many readers and, you know, get as much of an impact as they possibly can. And they think to do that, you know, the best way to do it is to leave a lot of detail out like that. And I think that that's a major mistake. I mean, you've really got to try and put as much detail as you can possibly tolerate, you know, into your books. Like that. Now, of course, there's always going to be an overload factor. There's going to be a point in time where you're like, okay, this is getting a little bit stupid. You know, and I remember when I was writing Kindness Goes Unpunished, my wife, Judy, I was so concerned with the fact that here I was, this cowboy writer out of Wyoming writing a book that took place in Philadelphia. You know, I put everything in there. I put every street name, I put every building, every fountain, every statue, everything. And finally, when Judy read the rough draft, she said, this thing reads like a voter's guide. You're going to have to get rid of a lot of this stuff like that because it's breaking up the flow, you know, of the book. And she was right. She was absolutely right. Like, and so I, you know, yanked a bunch of that stuff back out because it wasn't essential, you know, to the storyline. I was just trying to show off the fact that I had done the research, you know, and I knew what I was talking about. But I think, you know, that the essential, then the more detailed that you can be, you know, the better off you're going to be with your novel like that. I mean, you know, because readers are sharp. Readers are very, very sharp, and they retain a lot of those details. Like, and I mean, you know, I'll be writing a book, you know, 8 books down the road, and somebody will write and say, hey, you know, about 8 books ago, like that, you said blah, 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 like that, you know, and so you got to make sure you get it right, like that, because if you don't, like that, then you've broken that wall, like that, and then, you know, they don't see it as a real place or real characters.
Right.
And that's always what you're shooting for, like that, is the actuality.
Do you think those kinds of details and that type of character development is what's, is at least to some extent, helped these novels become a success, not only here, but worldwide? You're just at the beginning of another cross-country tour. You've done European tours to support books, and everybody seems to, I'm constantly surprised at this worldwide following of this small town sheriff, as you like to say, in the least populated county, the least populated state. It's fascinating to me. I love it. But we're here in America. We grew up in a, you know, a small city in a rural state. We love the Western United States. Mm-hmm. But people in Germany love these books, and France, and everywhere else. Is at least the character development somewhat attributable to that?
Oh, I think absolutely that's the case. Look at like any other genre, you know, whether it be mystery, whether it be Western, whether it be romance, science fiction, whatever, like that. You can't abandon character. You can't abandon the details that are going to make that character real. And, you know, I think an awful lot of readers, like, they expect that to a certain extent. You know, that they're not going to give that up, you know, and they're not going to forgive you, you know, if you try and, like, ride roughshod over that idea like that. And so I think that, yeah, those small details, like, that are what are going to, like, make or break, you know, the character. They're going to make or break the plot, too. It's not just character, it's place. You know, you have to be as detailed as you can possibly be, you know, about that place. You know, and the only way, I don't know, I guess I would have a hard time, you know, if I lived in an apartment in New York or LA or something and trying to write about Wyoming, especially that specific part of Wyoming that I write about, it would be very difficult for me to do that, like that, because I go out and, you know, I have, you know, these bits and pieces, you know, of Wyoming, you know, the smell, the sound, the taste, you know, the look, the color, you know, the temperature, all of those things like that are so, so important to me. And they inform, you know, Walt, you know, to such an extent. I mean, in the beginning of this book, like, you know, Walt talks about the wind. You know, he talks about the wind, you know. At the edge of the big parks, you know, up in the Bighorns, you know, asking the trees basically to come out and dance like that, you know. And the question becomes, you know, do the trees, you know, miss the wind, you know, whenever the wind is gone, you know. And first of all, it doesn't happen very often that the wind is gone in Wyoming.
It sounds like it. From what I heard in the book, it sounds like you guys have pretty constant wind.
It pretty much is. I think was it the Eskimos have 50 words for snow? Like that, and we in Wyoming have 50 words for wind. Like that, most of them not usable in polite society. Mm-hmm. Like it, and so, but you know, those are the actualities of place. And I think that, you know, if you leave those things out, then you got a problem on your hands.
Yeah, actually, I in similar straits. I remember writing a screenplay set in West Texas while living in LA, mm-hmm. and I'd been to Central Texas, I'd been to Austin, but I'd never been to West Texas. Mm. I'd seen movies and I'd seen that kind of thing, but I think imagination can only take you so far.
Yeah.
When you're trying at least for scenery, location, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
If you've never been there, there's only so far your imagination can take you without, well, you're going to lose a little of that authenticity.
Well, and an awful lot of the time, it's not the big epic stuff, you know, that's going to sell the idea.
Sure.
It can be something very small and seemingly insignificant, like that. But suddenly, you know, it's what it is that sells the idea, like that, or perfectly describes, you know, what exactly it is that you're trying to say. And you know, boy, being out there and listening and hearing and all that is the only way to get those.
Yeah, for sure. There's no question. And you mentioned it a second ago, so I do want to come back to this idea of the contemporary West versus maybe the old time Westerns.
Right.
And I've been curious about this as I've watched. The rise of the TV show Yellowstone that has become a very popular summer hit now.
Uh-huh.
I think it's now the most popular show on cable TV in the summertime. It's got huge ratings. It's doing very well for Paramount. The creator of that show has made a nice career for himself out of producing things like that. And I wanted to ask you, as you travel across the country and across the world, how are you seeing the Western United States, the modern West? How much do people talk about that? How are people viewing that kind of world? It's a little wishful thinking. I feel like I'm seeing a little bit of resurgence of material set in the West and having this modern West feel from your books and the TV show Longmire to Yellowstone. The Paramount Network's got another show coming out in 2020 that's set in the Southwest. There seems to be a little bit more of this focus than I remember several years ago. Are you seeing any of this?
Well, you're always going to fight that juggernaut of the epic romantic American West of the past.
Sure.
The period West. That's the biggest difficulty, of course. I mean, I'm always sitting there, you know, in those meetings with the Western Writers Association, and as always, there are all these people that are trying to rewrite, you know, Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey. Like, and I'm always like, Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey were pretty good at writing. Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey, maybe you need to try something different, you know. And so for me, the obvious thing was that, you know, try and do something contemporary. Like, because, I mean, I kind of write what I tend to refer to as socially responsible, you know, crime fiction. Like, and so I hope that the things that I'm discussing, the things I'm talking about, you know, I'm trying to get something, you know, a message across, mm-hmm. like that. And that's a lot easier to do, you know, in the world that we live in, you know. And so, I don't know. I mean, as far as, like, the media is concerned, am I seeing more and more involvement, like, at, you know, in a higher rate and a lot more of the, you know, the contemporary West? I don't know. It seems like, you know, yeah, there are a couple of shows out there now, like that, and every once in a while a movie will pop up, you know. But I think if you did a comparison contrast and did, you know, okay, contemporary Westerns versus, you know, period Westerns. Period Westerns are always the ones that win, like that, because everybody likes to ride the horses and shoot the bad guys and, you know, and do all that stuff like that. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's always going to be a niche like that, and I would hope, you know, that it helps that resurgence of the West as a whole, you know, as a genre, like that contemporary stuff, you know, kind of helps to kind of, you know, move that process along a little bit.
I guess maybe by the same token, are you seeing any kind of uptick as far as fans are concerned, that there seems to, is there potentially a more growing appetite? Certainly if Hollywood is greenlighting more shows, and if we're seeing more books written, that it's a pretty clear indication that want that material,
which is obviously.
Kind of where I'm basing some of this on.
I think that's definitely the case. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, with the success of Longmire,
right.
you know, and the fact that it's on Netflix and it's streaming 24/7, like that, it's not like, you know, we're waiting for reruns to come on or
right.
anything like that. It's on now all the time. And so what's been kind of interesting to see with that is, of course, you know, that it does trend, you know. And it was interesting too, because when the new book came out, when Land of Wolves came out here just, you know, what, 2 days ago, suddenly Longmire was trending, you know, on Netflix again.
Really?
You know, and we're still one of the top 15 shows on Netflix. Okay. And so that's, you know, kind of interesting to see, you know, whenever you've got a symbiotic kind of relationship between books and TV shows and movies and that type of thing, then yeah, I think one's going to advance the other. No two ways about it.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't. I hadn't thought about that, but it makes perfect sense that I'm sure there is, like I just said a second ago, an uptick in popularity of the Longmire TV show. When you release a new book, everybody wants to come back and they use the TV show to launch and reading of a new book, and they both work together back and forth and fuel each other.
They do. And it's, you know, it's interesting too, like that, because there's an awful lot of people out there that actually go back and reread all the books before they read the new book.
Wow.
Which is,
that's,
you know,
a commitment.
Used to, that was not that big of a deal, like that, but now that there are 15 of them, you know,
yeah.
like that, it's you know, quite an advancement. But yeah, and then, you know, the every day I'm still getting like emails from people that say, you know, I just found the TV show, you know, on Netflix, you know, and I've started reading the books. Like, you know, they'll watch the TV show seven times. They'll binge, you know, all six seasons about seven or eight times. And then they'll decide, okay, if I want any more right now, you know, it looks like I'm going to have to, you know, jump in and read some books. Like, but it's kind of interesting too, because, you know, you mentioned, you know, about Paramount and Yellowstone and all these things. I mean, what's going on right now is kind of interesting in the in that particular, you know, business, simply because they all, it's interesting, been interesting to watch all of the studios are slowly but surely kind of like, you know, pulling their material back from a lot of these streaming platforms and starting up their own streaming platforms, you know, like Paramount, Warner Brothers just, you know, what, 6 months ago said that they were going to start doing their own. And of course, Paramount doing theirs, Disney doing theirs, all these different groups. And I think what happened, of course, is they discovered that like making TV shows and movies is hard. Having streaming platforms is actually rather easy.
But yeah, that does make total sense, that it's almost a return to the old Hollywood system, the vertical Hollywood system where they owned the theaters, the production, the distribution, everything.
Yep.
So I think we finished up the, we took a quick little break in there for all the listeners. So hopefully we finished up and made our points about the kind of studio system and Hollywood now finding that direct pipeline to the audience with the streaming system. Yeah, if you're Warner Brothers, Disney has learned, why not send your stuff directly to the streaming service where everyone's watching their shows anyway. So we're going to see, you're right, we're going to see a huge rise in that. So maybe that's just new outlets for this new types of content.
I'm hoping that's the case. Like, and it doesn't turn back into an old studio system that, where they have so much control, they can, you know, strangle out the things that they really don't want to do, like Westerns. Like,
yeah,
you know, I'm
exactly.
hoping that won't be the case. But
yeah.
I don't know, as long as there's an interest, you know, as long as there's, you know, a viewership, you know, they're going to go with it.
Right. Yeah, no question. Yeah. If they think there's potential for it, they're going to make it.
Yep.
So let's wrap up with two questions back on the book about Walt.
Okay.
So again, I'm not going to give any details here. We'll talk around this central piece, but a new piece of technology has been introduced into Walt's life in this book, and we're not going to reveal what it is. I'm sure the listeners and anyone reading the books will enjoy that. What made now the right time to introduce this specific piece of technology?
You know, and I don't think it'll give anything away if we talk about what specific
piece of... Okay, it's up to you. I was going to stay coy with it.
I appreciate that. Well, actually what happened was, as I was talking to a dispatcher from... I did a speech for, like, you know, the Wyoming Dispatchers Association, and there was one dispatcher there who still would print out the emails of her sheriff and leave them on his desk so that he could handwrite the responses, and then she could go back and retype them in and answer his emails.
Wow, and that's real too.
It is, like, and it was just, it was, she'd had it, and she lowered the boom on him and said, hey, look, you're either going to start, you're going to get a computer and you're going to start answering your own emails, or else I'm retiring. Like, you know, and boy, nothing scares the living daylights out of a sheriff as much as like their dispatcher saying that they're going to walk out the door and never look back. And so, so I started thinking about it, and I thought, okay, well, Ruby's of a certain age where, you know, she's finally gotten to the point where she's like kind of had it. You know, it's become a luxury, you know, for Walt, you know, to not have to do this. And so it starts complicating things around the office there, you know, whenever this computer first arrives. It's certainly humorous, you know, what happens throughout the entirety of the book. Okay, I mean, that's always something that, you know, you always get surprised by. Like, at least I do. Like, I mean, I really went into this book thinking that, you know, boy, the issues that this book deals with are really dark, really weighty, you know, kind of social issues.
Yeah.
You know, and so I thought, this is going to be a really serious book. Okay, you know, and then after Depth of Winter, which was another book that was really serious, like it, and in many ways, you know, kind of like, you know, in comparison with the other books that I've done, like a little bit hyper-violent. But, you know, you try and do something different with each one. And I thought, okay, well, this is going to be a, you know, it's going to be a really kind of serious book. Okay. And then I don't think what I took into consideration was is Vic kind of comes roaring back with a vengeance, you know. And so she and Henry are always characters that I can count on for a lot of humor, you know, in the books. Okay. And so in this one, you know, she came roaring back. And there was a lot more humor in the book than I suspected, you know, whenever I first started. But and then, you know, the other major aspect, of course, is that technological, you know, aspect of trying to drag Walt Longmire kicking and screaming into the 19th century, you know. And so, you know, he just doesn't respond very well to technology. It's not something that he does really well. So it'll be interesting to see what people think about how I deal with that in the end, you know, if I've summed it up, you know, to their satisfaction or not.
Well, I know that I got particular enjoyment out of out of the character of Santiago.
Cesar Vittoria. Cesar Vittoria.
Sancho, yeah. I knew I was going to screw it up. I knew I was going to screw up his full name.
So I was reaching for
the shorthand, and I missed that, too.
Yeah, I mean, generally, what people do is they write me and go, that the Basque character with the 13-letter name. Like, that's what they do. Like,
I'll have to start doing that. But I was picturing scenes in there of him actually setting up computers for the office, and it was like flashbacks of anyone who's had to set up their computer through that, crawling under the desk, piecing it all together. Something's not going to work. So I love those moments. And they weren't necessarily written to be particularly humorous, but the fact that they happened, everybody's been through that.
Well, and Walt has no intuitive knowledge
and
of computers,
really,
you know. And so it's annoying to everybody else because he doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so I mean, even when he's trying to send an email, like, you know, and Ruby is like, it's the little paper airplane up on the right hand corner. He's like, paper airplane, that's clever.
Yeah.
You know,
like, left click and right click are challenges for Walt, which is priceless.
Yeah.
Priceless. And so that was the first half of the Walt stuff that I want to use to wrap up with. The second half is more serious, that this book finds Walt in a more introspective, contemplative world, and he's contemplating different things throughout the book that are new to Walt's world. And so again, without talking too much specifically about them, how much of that kinds of stuff that the readers will certainly understand and see is just natural aftermath from the trauma of Mexico, and how much of it is maybe genuinely hinting at things that might come in Walt's life down the road?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, when Walt gets ready to go down into Mexico, like, and Henry looks at him and says, you're going to have to go back, and you're going to have to find that guy that you were in Vietnam, because what you're walking into here is not a police action. You're walking into a war. And if you are not ready for that, then you're not going to make it back. Okay. And so Walt does. Walt unpacks that individual that he was as a Marine investigator in Tan Son Nhat Air Force Base in Vietnam, like that, back in 1968. Like that. Well, after unpacking that individual, you know, from the footlocker, he discovers that that individual does not want to go back into the dark night, you know, gently. He's not going back easy. Like, and so Walt's having to, you know, be confronted, you know, with himself. A past self that may be a little bit dangerous. Like, and so what that does, of course, is that, you know, not only is Walt, you know, in many ways, it kind of harkens back a little bit to the proverb that is the title of the book, that a land of strangers is a land of wolves. And Walt finds himself as a stranger in a strange land in his own home. You know, he can't make it all the way home. And then even worse, as a stranger to himself, he doesn't recognize who he himself is. And it starts having, you know, psychological, you know, difficulties for him, like, to try and overcome that. Like, and, you know, I write the books, you know, in a cyclical pattern, like that, you know, and they're a seasonal pattern. So it takes four books to get through 1 year of Walt's life. Like, and of course, I've said it before, like, that the great thing about that is Walt doesn't age as fast as the rest of us.
Right.
And so I can keep him going for a lot longer than, you know, anybody would suspect. Like that. And then the other thing is that it gives a resonance to each book. I mean, when you have, you know, a new book come out, it's only a month or two after the last book. And so I don't have the luxury of being able to ignore what happened in
the
previous
book.
I mean, he's got to deal with the things that happened. And in this one particularly, it's the chickens have kind of come home to roost.
Yeah, how do you repack that person that you had to unpack, basically? He's trying to put it back, but obviously it's not going to be an easy process.
No, he's not going into the eiderdown real easy, no.
Like, no. So I believe this is in the spring, right? It takes place in March. So this is the spring book, and next time we'll have a summer book.
We will.
Again, following your typical pattern, typically goes outside of Walt's comfort zone.
A little bit. Do you want a preview?
If you want a preview, go ahead. Everybody wants more.
I'm 13 chapters into that one already. Like it, so you know.
Take a break? Do you ever stop, or is it just continuous?
No, I had to do about like what 20 cords of firewood, and I had to do about 10 tons of hay, and you know, jackhammered an old, you know, hearth out of the old cabin up there on the mountains and stuff. And so I mean, there's a lot of physical work involved. You know, there's nothing like working with a jackhammer for about 3 hours to make you think, you know, damn, I like being a writer. You know, and it's one of those moments like that. They really hit me there. You know, but it's a joy. You know, I mean, I love the writing process. That's for me the big thing is I really still enjoy it after 15 years. I'm having a great time, and it's not boring like that because I'm able to do with the literary press I'm with. I'm able to go in any direction I want, do whatever I want to do. And Walt is, very conducive, to whatever it is that I might be interested, in writing about. But, the next one's actually called The Next to Last Stand.
Okay.
And I will tell you the probably the most, the biggest item in the entire book is a painting by a painter by the name of Cassili Adams. Look at, and I know you've seen the painting.
Okay.
Because it's called Custer's Last Fight.
Okay.
And to give you the history of it first, before you find out, where it is that you've seen it, Cassili Adams painted this painting about maybe 10 years after the actual Little Bighorn battle. And at that period in time, a lot of what artists would do is they would paint these big, huge canvases. Mm-hmm. And this one was about 9.5 feet by 16.5 feet. And then what they would do is they would take them out and tour them all over the country and charge people 2 bits to go in and see the painting. And basically the idea being that you would be seeing history. You would mm-hmm. see it the way it was. This is before movies, before
sure.
TV, all that kind of stuff. So they would tour these paintings. They took this painting out, they toured it, and they brought it back to St. Louis, where Cassili Adams lived, like that. And there was a big saloon near the train station in St. Louis, like that, and they bought the painting, like that, and they put it up on their wall as a conversation piece, like that. So there it was in the saloon in St. Louis, like that, for a number of years until the saloon went bankrupt. And their biggest creditor was a then, at that time, not so large brewery called Anheuser-Busch.
Right.
And Augie Bush walks down to the saloon, looks around at him and says, "You owe me $10,000. And they said, "We don't have any money at all. We're bankrupt." And he goes, "I'll take the painting." And so they took the painting off the wall, took it back, the headquarters of Budweiser, and Budweiser, and Bush decides, I'm going to make posters out of this thing. We're going to make prints. And I'm going to send them to every bar and every saloon in the American, all over the country, everywhere. And I can't remember how many copies they made. I believe it was over 2 million copies that they made of this print, of this painting. So I know, I'm pretty sure you've been in a saloon or a bar at one point in time, even just to go in and get, change to, park your car.
I glanced in a couple times.
Like it. And so, it may be the most seen art in American history, for gosh sakes. And, it's very, extremely, it's quite possible that this painting, in many ways, other than, Libby Custer, was one of the things that made Custer as much of, this bigger than life legend than he possibly was. Of course, it sold a lot of beer for Budweiser, and they became the largest brewer in the United States. And so after giving out, millions of these posters that they actually even sent, tubed posters to servicemen in World War I, for gosh sakes.
Wow. Still then they were
it was still going strong. And then after World War I, I think it was in the 30s, they shut down the idea of doing any more posters. And then they made a gift of the painting to the 7th Cavalry. At that point, the 7th Cavalry was in Fort Bliss, Texas.
Okay.
And so they gave the painting back to them, and they put it up on the walls of their commissary. And it was there until 1946 when the commissary burned down and the painting was destroyed.
Oh, no.
Or was it?
Uh-oh. Mystery.
So that's the beginnings of The Next to Last Stand, Walt's first art heist book.
Perfect. There's your cliffhanger, listeners. Maybe it burned down, maybe it didn't. Here we go. Cool. Obviously, that's a great way to relate the title. Fantastic. Looking forward to it next year. Maybe we'll be talking to you again right here at the
sure.
Poison Pen next year.
Or up at the cabin, either way.
At the cabin would be better. I would love to see that. Who knows where you'll be at in the reconstruction.
Absolutely.
Of it by that point.
Absolutely.
Like I said, as long as you got a front porch with a couple rocking chairs, something like that. I'll bring the bourbon.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure the insulation will be done, the ceilings will be done, the floors will be done, all the stoves and hearths will be all finished. So I think by next year it'll actually be remarkably habitable.
Perfect.
Keep it in mind.
I look forward to seeing it. Thank you very much. Appreciate
My
it.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Craig for another great interview. I hope to talk to him again next year at the Poison Pen or maybe at his cabin in the mountains. Who knows? And thank you all for listening. I'll be back soon with the full update. Talk to you then.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.